So in this session, we will be looking at fundamentally what is ethics. And we will start with a case from the New York City subway. This is not my picture. I didn't take this. I'm not sure exactly where it originated, but somehow it came into my Twitter or my X account at some point. And so I downloaded it. I thought it was good. This is, I can't remember his name, but he's one of the people who founded Google. And he is riding in the New York City, recognizably, in the New York City subway. And he's wearing these Google glasses, which I have printed or captured in a small picture beside. You might remember Google glasses. They were a very big thing for a very short time a few years ago. It was one of Google has a lot of corporate successes, but this was one of their failures, definitely. And they had this idea that the glasses have a camera that shoots out and takes pictures of things, captures those images, and then feeds it along this bar, which you can't see very well, but the frame of the glasses going back toward the ear is a kind of a Wi-Fi transmitter. So you're online, and the glasses could do all kinds of things, because it could feed the images it received up to the cloud and do whatever kinds of things happen there. For instance, we could imagine today facial recognition has advanced significantly. So if I were wearing the same Google glasses that he was wearing, presumably I could look at him, and I'm not sure how you would arrange this. You tap the glasses or something. There's some way that you command the glasses, but presumably one way or another, I could look at him and have his image sent to the cloud and work facial recognition, and I would actually know his name. So if I was wearing the Google glasses now, I could tell you what his name was. It would flash in my eye. And you can imagine this could be disconcerting. There's also quite a few advantages to this. For example, it would be good for me when I'm doing this session to actually know who that was. The Google Glass would be helpful in that way. It would also be good, for example, if you happen to be riding on a subway with someone who's a thief or something, if your Google Glass could identify that person as having this record of having stolen people's purses on the subway, that would be good information to have. If you see the person next to you and you see a woman here with her purse, right? That would be good information for her to have to hold on tightly as she seems to be doing to her purse. So there, you can imagine there are all kinds of real uses for this technology if you can make it work. Then there's all kinds of creepy things that could happen too. But what I want to start off with is this question. Okay, so that's what Google Glass is. And back when it was initially launched, people sort of had a good idea that's what it did. And we've kind of forgotten all that now because it disappeared so quickly. But putting ourselves back in that mindset back then, we could imagine sitting across from this person. And the question I'm asking is, well, if you were sitting with someone, just watching someone watch you with those crazy glasses, what kinds of conversation would you have? I don't mean exactly what you would say, but I mean what kinds of conversations, what the subject of conversation would be. And it seems to me that there are a few different kinds of things depending upon sort of who you're with and that sort of thing. And depending upon who you're with, what you might talk about. For example, if you happen to be with a bunch of scientists, I could imagine that you might talk about the material composition of these glasses. What are they made from? What are the steel frames made from? Or how much do they weigh? Or the crystals in the lenses, what are they made from? What is their density? You might ask, well, what is the size of the glasses in terms of inches or centimeters? You might ask, how much do they weigh sitting on your nose? And all those are kind of scientific questions that you could imagine someone asking. And there's a whole level of conversation that exists in our reality, which is a scientific level of conversation. So when you see something like Google Glasses, that's the vocabulary you use. You use inches and centimeters and ounces and density and volume, those kinds of words in that way of talking. And that way of talking, it seems to me, it's just completely different than the way of talking that might erupt if you happen to be sitting in the same place, but with an economist. So an economist, instead of talking about volume and centimeters and weight and so on, an economist is going to say things like, well, I wonder how much those glasses cost, or I wonder what kinds of incentives we could use to convince people to purchase the glasses, or I wonder if we cut the price of the glasses 10%, will we sell more than 10% units beyond what we did before in order to recoup the losses in profit through greater margin of sales. I don't know the answers to those questions, but that's the way economists talk, right? That's the kind of conversation they would have. And then just the basic vocabulary of that conversation is completely different than the scientific conversation. So instead of centimeters and volume and density, now we have dollars and incentives and sales, that kind of thing, right? So there are these, I'm trying to say that there are these levels of conversation that exist in our reality. It's not that there's just one way of speaking English. There are these different sort of sets of phrases and articulations and word meanings and uses and ideas about what is important that inhabit the way scientists talk, economists, and then next, going on to law, right? Sitting in the same place and looking at the same thing, the kind of conversation that might erupt if we were a bunch of lawyers might be, again, completely different. We might talk about certain rules that were promulgated from Washington, D.C., or that are promulgated by the state of New York or the city of New York, or maybe rules that the Metropolitan Transportation Authority imposes or tries to impose on their train, right? And people might say, well, look, in the city of New York, it turns out that using facial recognition technology is illegal. But in the state of New York, you could do that. And so they might talk about, well, what he's doing now is illegal. But if he gets out of the train and leaves the five boroughs and he's up in Westchester or something, well, then in that case, it's perfectly legal what he's doing. I don't know what the conversation would sound like. But the point I'm trying to make is that it's a third kind of conversation, which has a completely different vocabulary. It talks about what's legal and illegal and where the laws were passed and whether it's a law or a regulation and maybe what the punishments are for breaking the law. Is there a fine? Is there a penalty? Is there probation? Can you go to jail? Who knows? So science, one kind of conversation. Economics, another kind of conversation. Law, another kind of conversation. And many more could be added. But I want to bring this to the concluding point, which is that what ethics is fundamentally is it's a kind of conversation. It's a kind of vocabulary. But instead of the science volume and inches and centimeters, or the economics dollars and incentives, or the law regulations and geography, for ethics, the fundamental words are about human values. Things like privacy, social well-being, fairness, freedom, dignity, autonomy. These are the kinds of words that exist and define what ethics is. Ethics is the discussions and conversations that go on within that set or within that vocabulary, and that contain questions like, instead of how much does it weigh or how much does it cost, the question is, here I've posed, is my freedom worth more than your privacy? And what I mean by that is, I think it's true for most of us that if we're being filmed, like I'm being filmed right now, then we resist doing certain things. For example, I resist using certain language, like four-letter words or something. I try to resist that generally, but I resist it more assiduously when I'm being filmed, because I don't want to be seen talking in that way. So there is, I think all of us have this feeling that when we are being filmed, there's at least a certain degree of confinement, right? A certain degree of how we constrain our behavior. And so in a sense, we are less free. So his freedom, or rather, let me see how am I trying to explain this. His freedom to use the glasses is limiting my freedom to speak or to think or to act. And his freedom to wear the glasses is, in a sense, greater than my privacy, to use a different term, right? So privacy, as we're going to see in a few sessions, is the idea that we have control over access to our personal information. So if I'm being filmed, then obviously I can no longer control what you know about me, since that film can be taken and put on YouTube or anything else. So we could talk, just like we could in all the other examples, we could talk more about what the conversation, the specific words of the conversation mean, and what the kinds of questions we ask are. But what I want to underline, what's important is not that right now. That's what we'll talk about later. What's important right now is this idea of levels of conversation, this idea that ethics is a way of talking. It's a vocabulary. It's a way of understanding the world. It's ethics is part of the philosophy department. So it's part of an academic department, just like science and biology. They have their departments, physics, economics has their department, law has its department, ethics, philosophy, we have our department, and it has our own vocabulary and so on. So that's the first thing I want to say about ethics. Ethics is a way of talking, kind of like a language. That's a start. I think a little more formal definition will be that ethics is the idea that we conceive reality, that is, we make decisions and understand those decisions and justify those decisions in terms of human values. And what are human values? We're going to talk about that in just a little bit, but we've already said things like privacy, freedom, autonomy. Human values are things that are worth having in themselves. So we make decisions in ethics in terms of human values, as opposed to, say, in terms of, for the economist, they might make a decision in terms of price, what costs more, what costs less. The physicist or the scientist might make a decision about the quality of the glasses in terms of weight, which one weighs less. That might be preferable for the scientist if they're equally strong. So those are different ways of making decisions, the physical characteristics of the lenses or the cost of the lenses. But when we talk about ethics, when we look at those lenses you see there on the screen, right, we don't see something that has a cost. We don't see something that has a weight. We see something that inhabits or carries or projects human values. These glasses are about freedom. They are about privacy. They're not about how much. They're not about how much do they cost. They're not about how much do they weigh. They're not about are they legal or not. Okay, so that's a start for what I want to say about ethics. And one thing we will be doing in these sessions is we'll be trying to compare human definitions and thoughts about what these ideas are with ChatGPT, especially since this is, of course, aimed at computer scientists. So we can try that out now. Let's see what ChatGPT says. What is ethics? Actually, we should probably limit this. We'll say in 50 words or less, what is ethics? And we'll see what ChatGPT tells us. Okay, ethics is the study of moral principles that govern a person's behavior or the conducting of an activity. All right. So this is something we are going to see, because I've asked ChatGPT hard questions like this many times, and I've noticed a pattern, which is that ChatGPT tries to answer questions with the question. So, in fact, it does do that almost inevitably. Ethics, when it's a hard question, ethics is the study of moral principles that govern a person's behavior or the conducting of an activity. Well, that's just like saying ethics is the study of ethics. Right? Moral principles is ethics. What we want to understand is, what are moral principles? What is ethics? We don't want to be told that ethics is the study of ethics. And then they govern a person's behavior or the conducting of an activity. Well, that doesn't tell us anything either, right? Because The laws of physics can govern our behavior, like gravity keeps me down on the ground. Similarly, the laws of economics govern my behavior. I can afford to pay for one apartment, but not another. And so too, the human values of ethics will govern my behavior. But what I want to know is, what are those values and how do they govern my behavior? Not do they govern my behavior or not. So ChatGPT so far in the first sentence, as is very typical, tells us nothing. It involves systemizing, defending, and recommending concepts of right and wrong conduct, often addressing questions of morality, virtue, and the well-being of society and individuals. Okay, that second one is worse because it's wrong. It's wrong for reasons that I am going to want to talk about a little further on. But I think the reason why ethics is not about right and wrong is already starting to become clear. It's starting to become clear because we're saying that it's a discussion of human values more than which value should be chosen, or it's the way you justify one or another value as the value that should be chosen, as opposed to a simple rule that value A is better than value B. Now, I'm getting way ahead of myself. We're going to talk about this when we get to the case of COVID and contact tracing apps that were used in New Zealand and in other places. But for the moment, what I want to do is I want to say that first, ChatGPT, the way it answers questions is, first, it just answers the question by repeating the question. And then second, it gets it wrong. But I have to say more in order to show you why it's wrong to say that ethics is about deciding what is right or wrong. That itself is wrong, or it's incorrect, maybe better to say. But let's stick for the moment with the positive definition. So what is ethics? Ethics is conceiving reality, understanding reality, talking about our experiences in terms of human values, right? And we've just been going through and saying it's different than where the scientist talks, the economists, the lawyer, and it also differs from things like customs or traditions. So, for example, a fundamental ethical decision in the case of these glasses is, well, should I wear these glasses in public and use them to do facial recognition technology of the people I see around me? The ethical question has something to do whether I'm invading, as we said, their freedom to act because they feel self-conscious, or whether I am invading their privacy because I am stripping away from these people their ability to decide for themselves what is known about them, when and by whom, because I'm filming them and then I'm putting this on the internet or something, who knows what, right? So that's kind of the way, that is the way that ethics works and makes decisions. And that's completely different from customs and traditions. So for example, we could imagine maybe in 20 years, these kinds of Google glasses will come back and everyone will start wearing them. And we will just say, people will just start to say, look, I mean, everyone is wearing these Google glasses. And so if everyone else is going to wear them, then I am going to wear them, right? That's a perfectly legitimate way of making a decision about whether you should wear the glasses. It's just not an ethical way, that's all. We're making the decision there in terms of, as I say, traditions, or maybe not traditions, but in terms of customs, in terms of just what everyone else is doing. And if you think about it, most of the time, we make most decisions in that way. That's certainly the way I make most decisions. When I'm driving down the freeway, I could be looking very carefully at what the speed limit is and my dashboard and so on, but that's not what most of us do. Most of us, when we're driving on the streets of the city around the freeway, we sort of drive about as fast as the other people do. Right? We say, look, we could use law as our reference to make the decision, but instead we use customs. We just do what everyone else does. That makes a lot of sense most of the time. For example, another thing I do is whenever I'm lost and I'm in my car and I'm trying to get somewhere, I usually just say, don't have my iPhone or my battery has run out or something. I usually just say, well, I'm probably going where everyone else is going. So I sort of follow the flow of where most of the other cars are going. That usually works. Usually just doing what everyone else does, dressing like everyone else does, following everyone else in their habits and customs, that is a really good way to make decisions. In fact, that's the easiest, I think, and most efficient way of making decisions. And with respect to ethics, it's kind of like law or physics or economics in this way. If we insisted every day in making every decision in terms of ethics or in terms of pure economics or in terms of science, we would probably not get out of bed in the morning. There'd be so much to do. I mean, we can't decide everything based upon sort of high theoretical or scientific or philosophical principles. Right? When I get up in the morning, I need to put on a shirt and go out to go to work. And I can't do a complex economic analysis of how much this shirt costs and how much it will cost to wash and whether there's another shirt I could wear which is going to cost slightly less money and therefore I should wear that shirt. And I can't do that. I don't have time for that. You don't either, obviously. Right? So what do? I just kind of dress like everyone else does. So there's this other way of making decisions, customs or traditions, that makes a lot of sense. And that's a different way of thinking about the world, conceiving the world. And it is opposed again to things like religious dictates. There are people who make decisions according to what their religion tells them. And that also makes perfect sense. I'm not for it or against it, but what I am insisting is that that's a really different way of making decisions. When you're thinking about what you are told by one or another religion, regardless of what that religion might be, right, the language you use, the thinking that occurs in your mind, the way you make the decision is just completely different from when you make a decision in terms of what everyone else does, or when you make a decision in terms of pure economics or ethics or law and so on. And then again, finally, just another example, this idea of personal loyalties. It sometimes happens, right? We could just imagine, I'm just going to make this up, but we could just imagine that, let's say that one of my children was enrolled in this class and needed an A in order to get a good job or something, I would be tempted as the dad, I'm just making this up, but I think it probably would be true, that I would be tempted as the dad to just give my own son an A to help him out in his life. That makes sense. I mean, all of us feel that way about, at least sometimes, about our brothers and sisters and our parents and children and relatives and so on. Right? So there are personal loyalties too. That's another way of making decisions. So let's just stick with that example. I'm just making this up. Of course, this is not true, but let's just stick with that example of my decision to give someone an A in this class. I might do it for financial benefit, right? That would be economics. How much will you pay me? I might do it by a legal requirement. We could imagine, let's say legal in the broad sense, we could imagine that Pace University promulgates a rule that everyone who is in the upper fifth of the class in terms of performance gets an A, so that I'm forced to give an A by the regulation. I might do it by custom or tradition. Like normally I give people who score above 90% an A, and I might do it in terms of ethics. And in terms of ethics, I probably would distribute the A's in terms of some notion of fairness that I had sort of worked over and developed in my mind, right? So we can think of, I can give out grades in terms of fairness, in terms of who pays me, in terms of family loyalty. Those are all different ways of dealing with the world. Right? And it goes back to this, the first slide we talked about where I said, look, there are these different kind of conversations you can have. There are these different languages you can speak. And these are more than just different languages. These are different ways of acting and making decisions and justifying decisions in the world. And what it means fundamentally to be a scientist is to learn that language in that way of justifying decisions. What it means fundamentally to do ethics is not to decide what's right or wrong. Instead, it is to understand terms like fairness, privacy, autonomy, speak that language and make decisions in those terms, as opposed to in terms of economics or religion and so on. So that's the definition I want to give of ethics. Ethics is making and justifying decisions in terms of human values, with human values understood as autonomy, fairness, privacy, and so on. And then the act of doing ethics, beyond simply casting or understanding our reality in terms of values, is to understand or think about what we are doing in terms of which of those values or what is worth having intrinsically. Something that is a human value is literally something that is valuable, but not valuable economically. Instead, valuable in the human sense intrinsically. It's something that we want for itself. So here think about the difference between, say, freedom, personal autonomy, and money. No one wants money for itself. People want money in order to get other things, right? You want money so you can afford a larger apartment or a nicer car or more clothes or what have you, right? But no one just wants money. By contrast, something that is a value in ethics, that is something which is worth having intrinsically on its own. So freedom, personal freedom, my ability to determine for myself what I am going to do today, like what am I going to have for lunch? I want to decide that for myself. Something like that, it is an expression of personal freedom or autonomy, and that's worth having on its own. I want to be free, not for some other reason. Instead, I want to be free because I want to be free. That's what a value is. A value is something that is intrinsically worth having. A value is something that I want not in order to get something else, but just because I want it itself. And as I say, I think an example that I frequently use in this kind of context is this contrast with money. Money is very valuable, no doubt, but it's not a value. It's not something we want in and of itself. We only want it so that we can get something else. Right? Okay. So we have this notion that what ethicists are doing is they're speaking a certain language, which is the language of values, and they're speaking that in a way which justifies their decision. And now we've said, well, at least in general, what are these values? And these values are things that have intrinsic worth that we want just because we want them and not because we want to use them to get to something else. And so here I have a list of values, right? Sometimes it's easier to explain things instead of giving the definition, just give a lot of examples and let people sort of figure it out. That I've tried the definition approach. Here's the other approach. So we have things like, happiness. That makes a lot of sense. We want to be happy. We don't want to be happy in order to get something else. We just want happiness, vitality, sort of the enthusiasm for life, health, also something maybe we want for ourselves, integrity, autonomy, privacy, dignity, courage, fairness, solidarity, well-being, safety. I think almost all of these things are things that we at least can conceive of being as being things that are worth having on their own. Maybe something like, I sort of caught myself on the third one, like health. Of course, it's true that we want health for subsequent reasons also. For example, I can't really be free. I said today for lunch, I want to go out and I want to choose whether I have a hamburger or a hot dog, let's say. But if I'm not healthy, if I can't walk, let's say, I'm laying in bed ill, well, then I can't go out and express my freedom. So It's true that I want health as a kind of mediated value. I want health in order to get freedom, in order to get self-determination, in order to get my autonomy. That's true. But I think also that health is something that is intrinsically good. Mm-hmm. Feeling healthy is good. It's not exactly something that makes us happy. I mean, happy is a little different sort of contentment. Health is more a sense of fulfillment, I think, we have. But again, what I want to stress is, it seems to me that health is a value in the sense that it's something we want just because we want it. Now, we might also want it because it lets us do other stuff, but there's part of what it means to be healthy that exists within that range of being just a pure ethical value. It's something that is intrinsically valuable. It's something that's worth having on its own. And so if that's what a value is, and if health counts and happiness counts and vitality and well-being and fairness and courage and dignity and all that stuff, fidelity, honesty, gratitude, reparation, civility, you can see there are a lot of values. Many, many, many things can count as a value in ethics. Similarly, just like if you study economics or science and so on, right? It doesn't take long studying science to learn that it's not just weight and length and volume. There's all kinds of other measurements. There's acceleration and derivatives of acceleration and so on that scientists have learned to measure. So the list of, or the vocabulary list that belongs to science, like the one that belongs to economics, like the one that belongs to ethics, goes on and on and on. And so part of acquiring the skill in those various things is learning as great a part of that vocabulary as you can. Now, we're not all going to become world-level ethicists in just one class, so there's going to be some limit to the number of values that we can study and we can look at. But I do put this as a list so you can get a sense of what is out there. Okay, so kind of moving toward the wrapping up of the initial definition. We have this idea that ethics is conceiving of reality and justifying decisions in terms of human values. And then there are corollaries. The first, I've been saying this more or less explicitly the entire time, but I'll put it directly now, is that learning ethics is like learning a language. Just like learning physics is like learning the language of physics, mass and volume, density, and so on. So too, learning ethics is just like, it's like learning a foreign language. If you're going to learn Spanish someday, right, you learn a set of words and what they mean. Well, so too ethics. We're going to be learning ethics in this class, which means we'll be learning a certain vocabulary. We will be learning what those words mean. We will be learning how we put them together in sentences and paragraphs, how we make them work in the world to produce meaning. So I think doing ethics, learning ethics, is in some significant sense, it's like learning a language. And then now I can come to the point that I wanted to make earlier. Doing ethics is not about selecting right from wrong so much as producing better and worse evaluations and privileging values. Okay, what does that mean? The first part, I think, is pretty clear. Doing ethics is not about selecting right from wrong, right? That's what ChatGPT said. That's incorrect. Instead, it's at least primarily or fundamentally or first about producing better and worst evaluations. Okay, evaluations means understanding, evaluating, as we implied on the previous slide. Evaluating means understanding experiences in terms of values. That's what it means to evaluate. You put experience in terms of values. So when you see the Google glasses, right, the way you respond to that is not by putting it in terms of economics, how much does it cost, but instead in turn you evaluate it. You put it in terms of values, like, does this violate my privacy? Does this grant the wearer a certain higher level of autonomy and freedom? I think the answer to both those questions is yes, it does violate. If I'm being watched, observed by that, it violates my privacy. But it does give a greater amount of freedom to the person who's wearing the glasses, because they're more aware of things like, well, who around me might be trying to steal my purse or something. So when I say Ethics is about producing better and worse evaluations. It's about just that. It's about being able to look at someone wearing Google glasses. Oops, going the wrong way here. Someone wearing Google glasses and being able to render that image, being able to present that reality in terms of the values that matter. And I think that this is a pretty easy case, at least superficially. The values that matter here are privacy. He's taking away my ability to decide who knows what about me, to a certain extent, and personal autonomy or personal freedom. I mean, he's gaining a lot of freedom because he knows a lot more about what's going on around him. But I'm losing some freedom, right? Because when I'm being stared at by him with his glasses, then I suddenly, as I've said, I feel constrained. There are things I don't want to do. There are ways I do not want to talk. So being able to say those things, that's what ethics is. Ethics is the ability to speak the language of values when you have an experience like this. And that language is just very different than the language of the economist or the scientist and so on. Okay? So that's when I say ethics is about producing better and worse evaluations. That's what I mean. It's saying, being able to say cleanly and crisply and clearly, what are the values that are at stake when someone wears Google glasses? That's what doing ethics is. And then the second part is privileging values. This is the point where ethics does connect with the idea of right and wrong. When I say privileging values, what I mean is that when I look at the person wearing these Google glasses, I'll give it to you again. When I look at the person wearing these Google glasses, I fundamentally need to make a choice. Not fundamentally. One choice that I could make in this situation is I could say, look, there is a conflict here between his freedom. He should be free. People should be free. If they want to wear a certain kind of glasses, more power to them. No one objects to my wearing the glasses I wear. I think all of us agree that that's an aspect of my autonomy, my self-determination. All of us should be able to choose which style of glasses we want to wear. No problem, right? So there's, on one level, there's no objection whatsoever to his wearing those glasses. But on the other hand, then you say on the other side, well, wait a minute, though. Those glasses do have a camera. And so those glasses do interfere with my privacy, right? With my control over what information people have about me. I'm being stared at by a camera. So for ethics, when I talk about privileging values, ethics is about privileging values. What I'm saying is we have to make a decision about what's worth more. Is his freedom to wear his glasses as he wants worth more than my right to have privacy, to not be filmed when I'm wandering around in the subway? Or conversely, is my right to privacy greater or stronger or heavier than his freedom to wear those glasses? Now, when you make that decision, what follows out of that is a kind of yes or no answer to should the glasses be worn. But that's not what ethics is about. Ethics is not just deciding what's right or wrong. Ethics is about everything that led up to that. Ethics is about rendering what happened in terms of values and then deciding which value will have priority, privacy or freedom. And then once you do that, that's the work of ethics. That's doing ethics. Then you have an answer. If you say his freedom is worth more than my privacy, it's New York. Everyone sees everything. Don't worry about it. Let him do what he wants to do. Cool. No worries. All we're saying is that freedom is worth more than privacy, and so he can wear the glasses. Whereas by contrast, a different ethicist might say it doesn't matter if we're in New York or in Kansas City or in Las Vegas or what have you. People simply don't have a right to film others without their consent. And they don't have that right because the people who are being filmed no longer have control over where their image will be used and how it will be used. Because that film can be put up on the internet, on YouTube, on God knows what, and so on. And that violation, well, first, that is a violation of my privacy. And then second, the argument could be made that it doesn't matter that everyone sees everything in New York. It's still true that my privacy is being violated by the fact that you're filming me. And that violation, or that the value of that privacy which is lost, is greater than the value of your freedom to wear those glasses. So therefore, you should not wear the glasses. That's the way ethics works, or that's the way values are privileged. And then I say, I make a good point that I like to make, that if ethics were simply about right or wrong, if it was that simple, you know, this is right, that's wrong, this is good, that's bad, if it were like that, then we wouldn't have this class. There would be no reason for this class. All we would do is have a kind of ethics calculator. It would be just like math. Just like the calculator tells us 12 plus 12 minus 6 is 18. So too, we would put in, should I lie to grandma? Yes or no. But that's not the way it is. Sometimes we lie to grandma, sometimes we don't. For example, so we don't have scandals here. Let's just imagine that I'm supposed to be my mother now, or maybe your grandmother, is quite elderly and never leaves the house, and she's gone colorblind in her years, and so the clothes she wears are kind of bizarre in terms of the color combinations. But she doesn't see that. She doesn't know that because she has lost the ability to see colors clearly, and no one else knows either because she never leaves the house. So in that situation, if your grandma asks you, how do I look today? You could say, oh, grandma, you look terrible because you're wearing crazy colors. But you're not going to do that. Why are you going to bury her in anguish and anxiety when you can just say, you look great, grandma. She'll feel good. It doesn't matter. I mean, I think most people in most situations will just say, grandma, you look great. Is that a lie? Yes, it is. Should you do that? Yeah, probably, right? If we had ethics as just being a calculator, it would say, like, no, you can't lie. No. But that's not the way the world is. So the way the world actually is one where we need ethics, and first, and second, it's one where ethics can't be like a calculator, and there can't be rules for right or wrong. They don't work. In any situation you can come up with where you think there could be an absolute rule applied, it might take me some time, but I'm pretty sure that I could come up with a different situation where the rule you invented would fail. Right? So say something simple like lying. Well, I've already done that with the colorblind grandma. People will say, well, we should not kill. Usually that's true. But if someone is killing many other people, should you kill that one person to stop him or her from killing many others? It seems like a lot of people would say yes. I'm not asking for answers to these questions. I'm making the point that there are no easy answers. And because there are no easy answers, right, there is no such thing as an ethics calculator. We can't just get yes or no, right or wrong. And because that's true, fundamentally, ethics is not about deciding right or wrong. We don't know. We don't know. What ethics is about is laying the foundation to make decisions that we understand in terms of human values. Right? In the same way that an economist would say, look, an economist, you can go to an economist and ask about stocks, right? And you can say, well, what stock should I buy? The economist will say, I don't know. But what the economist can do to help you is the economist can say, typically in high inflationary times like we have now, the value of treasury bills or bonds, whatever they're called, treasury units, the treasury bonds, their value will typically go up. So maybe you should do that. But the economist doesn't know what's going to happen tomorrow. The economist can only tell you that the kind of thing you should think about in inflation are treasury bills and whether stocks will increase with inflation or decrease with inflation and so on. They can give you questions to ask and ways to think, but they can't make a good decision necessarily. Well, at least they can't make a necessarily right decision. If they could, then everyone would be an economist and we would all be rich, right? But economists are just like everyone else. They don't know any better than we do about which stocks to buy. They just help us understand the decision better. Ethics is the same thing. I don't know any better than anyone else about what decision to make when I'm considering whether to lie to grandma. But I am better than most people, presumably, I am better than most people at framing the discussion, at understanding how the decision can be made, at analyzing the sort of language that is used, at presenting the values which are put into conflict in this situation. I can do all that stuff. And we're going to learn to do all that stuff in this class. But right or wrong, at the end of the day, that's different. That's different. Right? That's the privileging of one value over another. But that's no longer the work of ethics. That's what comes after ethics. Ethics is about preparing to make a decision, not the decision. So that's why, in a more complete way, that's why ethics is not about right and wrong. Right? I think that frequently when you ask just people on the street, well, what is ethics? They will say it's about right and wrong. We say that, that's the kind of thing, sometimes people will ask me that and I will say it's right or wrong, but that's the kind of thing we say at cocktail parties, so people leave us alone. No one who actually does ethics really thinks that. Don't tell anyone that that's what I do at cocktail parties. All right. So a very good example that I started using, of course, during COVID, but I've kept using it because I think it's a very good example. I think the Google Glass is also a good example. But the tracer apps, these applications that came out to be used during COVID, where people, this was in New Zealand, they had the most extreme form of this, where they said people would have to carry on their phone as sort of, well, it's their phone, so they have a record that they have it. And then when they would go to a place, they would check in by showing the barcode of their phone. And so the government would know where everybody was in case, and it makes perfect sense, in case it turns out, let's say I come down with COVID, the government can immediately go back and see, okay, look, Brousseau yesterday was at the supermarket and John Smith and Jane Jones and Bill Johnson and so on were all also at the supermarket. So we better check and see if they're sick or not. And the day before that, Brousseau was at the post office and who was at the post office and so on. So, I mean, it makes perfect sense that you would want to have that information. And there's really good justification for it. The justification, the ethical justification, one of them is the value of social well-being. That's something in terms of health. That's something I think almost all of us believe is worth having intrinsically, right? We want people to be healthy. It's good. That's desirable. It's worth having in and of itself. We don't want people to be sick with COVID. So that's a value. It's something that's worth having. And then putting in these tracer apps, that is one way to get that value or to achieve it. But it's also true, people said in New Zealand and elsewhere, that it's also true that if this information is out there, it's hard to contain it. That is, it ends up spilling out into other databases and people can find out where you were. So if I'm checking in literally everywhere I go and that data leaks out and spills out, people can find out a lot about my life. And maybe I'm in some places where I don't want people to know I'm at. Just use your own imagination. We could imagine that everyone thinks that I am a I'm just making this up. Everyone thinks that I am a very devout Catholic, but in fact, I am converting to Judaism. So I'm not sure what day, every Friday or something, I am at the synagogue doing my Hebrew lessons or some such, but I don't want people to know that. However, if you get my location tracing app from my phone, it might be kind of obvious that something like that is happening. Why else would I be there every Friday? And then you can use your own imagination, right? There's a lot of other things. You can imagine places that I'm at where people might ask, oh, why are you at that place at this time every so-and-so, right? So pick your own embarrassing piece of information to put in the blank there. What's important is that regardless of whether we're talking about religion or something else, there is a privacy concern, that is information about me, is being taken from me and being distributed to the government and to God knows who else by virtue of these tracer apps. If I really have to check in everywhere, right, the government and others are going to know a lot about me. So you, and that's something that's, and that protecting, I think most of us believe that protecting that information, letting me decide for myself who knows what religion I'm interested in, or other, or what political party I want to be supporting, or other things too that you can imagine. Most of us believe that me making my own decisions about who has that information concerning my identity, most of us believe that that privacy, that that's something that's worth having too. That's valuable in and of itself. So we have privacy as something that is valuable in and of itself, and that's going to stand against these tracer apps. That's a strong argument, right? We can justify refusing to use these tracer apps, and we can justify objecting to their use, and we can justify voting out politicians who enforce their use, right? We can justify all those actions by recourse to this value of privacy. We can say, look, it's privacy is worth having, and it's worth more. And because it's worth having, we should get rid of the COVID app. So what we have at the end of this now is the people who support privacy saying, get rid of the COVID app. The people who support social well-being say, keep the COVID app. And it's not, they end up being against each other. It looks like they're against each other, right? Some are against the app and some are for the app. And in our world where everything is always about conflict, that's what the only thing you would see on TV is that everyone is against each other. But the truth is, what's really happening is that both sides are participating in the same basic ethical exercise, right? They're both sides understand that we're pitting, that we're setting in one form or another the value of privacy against the value of social well-being. The people, let's just say that I'm a privacy advocate, and so I want the COVID app to be discontinued. That doesn't mean I'm against social well-being, right? I'm probably for privacy and for social well-being. Just like the people who are in favor of the COVID app because it supports social well-being, they're probably also for privacy. We both agree. We both want privacy. We both want social well-being. It's just that. It's just that. If I'm for privacy, I think that privacy, individual privacy, is worth more than social well-being. Whereas the people on the other side, they think social well-being is worth more than privacy. But again, what I want to underline is the stuff you see on TV that about conflict and everything, no, that's not the way it is. We fundamentally agree about almost everything. We fundamentally agree that we're doing ethics. We fundamentally agree that social well-being and privacy are both worth having. The only disagreement we have is on top of all that common ground is we have this idea that they think that social well-being is worth more than privacy, and I think that privacy is worth more than social well-being. That's almost a detail. That's what gets the attention, but it's almost a detail. The ethics, the real part, the substance, is all that stuff that was before that. Understanding the world in terms of privacy and social well-being. Right. So this is another way of making this point, going back way back to the ChatGPT, what I consider to be a misdefinition, the ChatGPT definition that ethics is about right and wrong. No, it's not. It's about learning to do with the language of human values. It's about justifying decisions in terms of values. And then finally, it's about privileging one value as being more important or being heavier than another one. And then action follows from that, but the right and wrong part, that's only secondary. It's detail. So that's the definition of what ethics is. Why don't we take 5 minutes and you can just think yourself about the COVID app and try to think about whether you would impose the COVID app or prohibit the app. And maybe you would think in terms of social well-being and health, or maybe you would think in terms of privacy, that's fine. Or maybe there's some other value you might have that's involved there that you might want to think of. That's the kind of thing you could explore just for a few minutes here. Okay, so what we are doing today is, or in this session is, we're defining ethics, and then the next thing I want to do is talk a little bit about ethics and law, because I talked about how ethics is different than physics, different than economics, and most people are completely clear about that. It makes perfect sense. But the question of ethics and law, I find, frequently is one where people have some hesitation. People who will immediately say, look, I agree that physics and ethics are completely different, but law and ethics, don't they overlap? Aren't they in some ways the same? I'm not sure. That's what we're going to talk about next. And then we'll talk about that sort of nuts and bolts of ethics in terms of how many principles and values we should have. But first, let's talk about ethics and law. Basically, as I've implied, there are two ways of thinking about this. The first is something like rain and snow. That is, ethics and law are two different versions of the same fundamental thing, right? They're different ways of doing the same thing. And so rain and snow, obviously. The other version is that ethics and law are like rain and Mondays. Sometimes it seems like Mondays, because they're depressing and we have to go back to work and so on, sometimes it seems like Mondays are more rainy than other days, but I suspect that's not really true. And that the connection between rain and Mondays is just purely accidental. It could be rain on Monday, or it could be sunny on Monday, it could be rain on Tuesday. They really have nothing to do with each other, right? So the rain and Mondays idea is the idea that ethics and law is like ethics and economics. They're just different things, that's all. So I have a case to think about that. This is a real case. Today's kind of a COVID day, I'm suddenly realizing. This is a case that I worked on back in the time of COVID, and it really brought forward, the whole COVID thing, because there were so many new decisions that had to be made, it was a good time to find ethics cases, because the usual ways we have to make decisions, customs, law, regulation, a lot of those ways of making decisions were breaking down, right? I mean, we couldn't just do things the way we had always done them. We couldn't just do things the way the law said, because the circumstances had changed so much that the laws no longer fit the reality, and the customs were completely inapplicable to the new kinds of experiences we were having. So that COVID was also an outbreak of ethics in terms of decision-making for that reason, because we lost a lot of the familiar guideposts that we had. And here's a specific case where exactly that happened. This is a case I worked on in Brescia, Italy, which is North Italy. It's almost ground zero of the COVID pandemic in the West. The very first case occurred just to the north west of Brescia, just a little bit, and it rapidly spread to Brescia and then Bergamo and Milan and that area. But Brescia was right at the ground zero. And so they were getting a lot of cases, and these are people in the hospital. This is the one with the mask is an actual doctor in the hospital in Brescia. Then the other two, the one with the blue mask and then the one without a mask, and there are two with glasses, those are computer scientists who were working on artificial intelligence that would analyze chest x-rays and find things like cancer and infections and so on. In other words, it would do the job of a radiologist. You could take someone's chest x-ray and the artificial intelligence would determine, well, this person has cancer or does not have cancer and so on. And as I say, the one without glasses, he is a doctor at the hospital. So COVID breaks out. I mean, no one knows what it is. We just know that people are getting very sick and they're pouring into this hospital. The hospital is overwhelmed. They're taking chest x-ray after chest x-ray after chest x-ray. And then it starts happening that, because of course COVID is so contagious, that the radiologists who were diagnosing these chest x-rays, they started dying. And so the patients were coming in at an ever greater rate. More and more chest x-rays are being produced. The radiologists who can read the x-rays are themselves getting sick, and then they're dying. And now the hospital has no way of keeping up with this demand. So what happened is the two computer science people got together with the doctor and they said, look, we can quickly adopt our technology, our AI technology, to diagnose COVID and to say how advanced the disease is in the lungs, and therefore to create a prognosis. You know, this is what will happen, what might happen, and also to treat the disease. Okay, in your case, you should do X because it's your situation is X, and in your case, your situation is Y, so you should do Y. Right. So the chest X-ray was a very important tool in the hospital at that time. And as I say, radiologists were not there, so they couldn't read the X-rays. The two artificial intelligence people come in and say, we think we can adapt the technology we have to diagnose all these chest X-rays that are getting taken and that we right now we can't read. They said one, and they said two, all we need to do is we need to take the chest X-rays that have already been read by doctors and been marked like COVID degree one, COVID degree two, and so on. We need to take those chest X-rays and put them in the machine. We're not going to get too technical here, but we're going to use them to, in a sense, teach the machine what it should look for when it looks at a chest X-ray and what it should call COVID. So they have, it's called training data, right? So they have this stack of X-rays that they can use to train their computer to take a new X-ray and say, well, that's COVID, that's not COVID, that's stage three COVID, and so on. They proposed they could do that. Sounds like a very good idea. Was a very good idea. They needed that. There was a problem. This is the problem. In Italy, like in the United States, and like in most places in the West, in order to use a patient's health data, you need to get their explicit consent. They have to sign a form. Say, well, yes, you can use my health data. The problem in Italy was that all this had happened so quickly that people were not asking for the permission to use the X-rays, or maybe people were not giving the permission because they were accustomed to just not checking that box. And then people left or they died and so on. So they had this huge stack of X-rays there, but they had not acquired the legal permission to use them in the technology or to use them at all for science. So here's the situation, putting all this together. You have this strange new disease. People are pouring into the hospital. The radiologists are dying. The chest X-rays are being taken, but you can't read them. Artificial intelligence can do the work, we think, but you have to break the law. Here's the key point. You have to break the law to take these X-rays and use them to train the machine. So do you do that? Do you break the law in order to save the lives of these people? Save the lives of future patients who are coming in? Well, it's not entirely clear. For people who want to say, look, the law and ethics are two different things, what they are going to say is, look, the law says what it says, and if ethics says we should do something else, right, then they just remain two different ways of looking at the world. So someone doing ethics might say, the value of social well-being in this case, and saving lives, people who are suffering from COVID, is worth more than the value of privacy, which is also important. But the value of privacy, which demands that we don't use people's personal medical information without their permission. Both those two values are important, we recognize. However, in this extreme case of COVID, the social well-being importance outweighs the privacy importance. So we should use those X-rays even though we're violating their privacy. And if you want to say that law and ethics are kind of the same thing, then you say, well, look, that same argument works against the law, too. We should just ignore the law and use the X-rays. Whereas by contrast, if you want to maintain a very strict line and say the law and ethics are distinct things, then that reasoning doesn't work, right? That reasoning just says, well, the ethicist thinks we should do it, but we follow the laws here and we shouldn't do it. And they got caught in that debate. And at least initially, the lawyers, let's see how we're going to work this for this side. Here, more or less, I'm saying that they are, I'm giving the explanation that I've just given you all, more or less in the same order. So here in the next slide, I'm saying that if you see the law and ethics as like rain and snow, as working organically together, then you think that, well, this privacy argument also sort of works for the law, right? The fact that the social well-being is worth more than privacy is like saying that the social well-being is worth more than this particular part of the law. And there are probably other parts of the law that say things like people in the hospital, like you can always find it, right? People in the hospital are legally required to serve the patient's interest and to make them healthy. I'm sure that exists somewhere in the law everywhere, right? That there's regulations that the hospital people must help the health of the patients. So once you have that kind of conflict, it says on the one side, you can't use the information, but on the other side, you have to help the patients. Right? Then you can say, look, it's just like ethics. On the one side, we have social well-being. On the other side, we have privacy. And in this case, helping the patients is more important than getting the consent. In this case, helping the social well-being is worth more than the privacy. That's all. So ethics and law in that way are sort of the same things. And you can think that way. Or by contrast, and this is what happened in Brescia, is that the people who were advocates of the law refused that logic and said that the law takes precedence over ethics and said that the law, if people broke the law, then legal penalties must be assigned to those people for what they did, regardless of the situation, COVID or no. And so the doctors and so on were very hesitant to use these x-rays because they were afraid they might end up going to jail later on, right? That's very reasonable. Part of ethics is also worrying, protecting yourself and protecting your own autonomy and freedom. And you can only do that if you're outside of jail, right? So it's perfectly reasonable to say, as long as the people who are enforcing the law are not willing to acknowledge that the law, the technical law should be breached to allow us to look at these x-rays and use them to train the machine, as long as that exists, then I'm not going to do it. I don't want to go to jail. And that, as I say, that was the situation for some time in Brescia. But fairly quickly, they filed a kind of appeal with the government. And the government came to a very interesting decision. They essentially said that the area of the hospital at that time within the COVID was an area where law did not apply. They said, essentially, we cannot tell you that it is legal to use these x-rays to train your machine, but we can tell you it's not illegal or legal. It's neither one or the other. It's kind of like, I'm not sure if you've ever seen the movie The Purge, where you have like 24 hours, there's no law. Well, it's not exactly like that, of course. But in some sense, it's kind of like that, right? They essentially said, look, there is this area of reality where there is no law. It's not legal. It's neither legal nor illegal. We're in a crisis situation. Law is, in a sense, suspended in that area. And as soon as they said that, then right away, bang, the whole group could make the ethical argument that social well-being outweighed privacy concerns at this moment in the situation. They were immediately conceded that argument, and then they immediately used the x-rays, trained the machine, it worked, and they saved countless lives in Italy, and then maybe in other places too, because they sent the results and the program to other places. Everything was very confused at that time, so it's hard to get exact facts. But certainly they saved lives there at that hospital, and they saved lives because, in essence, they made the claim that ethics is independent of law. There are two different ways of doing things, and so we don't need to really worry about sticklers insisting that the privacy rules are so important that they cannot be breached even in a national health emergency. Now, that's, by the way, that's a respectable position. I'm not saying that's a wrong position. I am just saying that On the practical level, the easiest way to get to avoid that concern is just to say that we're going to make an ethical decision as opposed to a legal one. And that's what they did. And the point of all this is that, at least in this case, what was decided, or what was understood in the background, is that ethics and law are two completely different things. They're two different ways of making decisions. When the law is imposed, it seemed like it was going to be very hard to violate that privacy constraint. Whereas when it was pure ethics, it was much easier to say the value of social well-being was higher than the value of privacy. So again, it's this idea, what I'm trying to get at in this case is, it's possible to think of law and ethics as just being two different ways of making decisions. Law and ethics is just like ethics and economics, or ethics and physics, just different ways of making decisions. That said, there's no ultimate answer to the question, because many people take the opposite position and they say, look, what law tries to do, and there's a whole field of study here, they say what law tries to do is make kind of vague, abstract rules very concrete and practical for people to use in everyday life. Why? Because as I sort of said at the initiating point, no one can wake up in the morning and make every decision they make in terms of ethics. It would just go on for hours and hours. Like, which shirt should I wear in terms of ethics? That I could write a dissertation on that. Right? So I could never even get out of the house, because I would be doing ethics all morning. So what law does, this argument is, what law does is it takes all that abstract stuff and just cuts it down into bite-sized pieces so that we can get on with our day doing little things. Like when we're trying to figure out what speed to drive on the highway, instead of going into these great discussions about what is my freedom to do whatever I want and how does that weigh against the social well-being of others who might be driving more slowly, and instead of all that, they just say, look, the way that balances is you drive 55 and that's it. No more talk. Just drive 55. Go on with your life. Listen to the radio, right? So that's the other argument, the argument that law at least attempts to be some kind of form of ethics, a more practical and a bite-sized and applicable form of ethics. And you all just have to make your own decision about that. There's no answer. We don't have any set answer to that. It could be on the one side that ethics is just its own thing, distinct from the law, or it could be that there's a special relationship between ethics and the law, and the two are like snow and rain. There are different ways of doing the same thing. So you could ask, I've given you a more or less complete idea of what this conundrum was. Basically, they were in a situation where to save lives, they had to break the law. They got out of it by getting this reprieve from the government. But imagine they did not get that reprieve. Would you break the law to save these lives? Yes or no? That's an ethical question with two senses. It's an ethical question in which you're asking first, you know, what is worth more, privacy or social well-being? Because it's perfectly possible to argue, look, even if it costs lives, privacy, personal privacy is so important that we cannot use these chest x-rays without consent. You can argue that. It's very reasonable. Or you could argue the other side, that with regardless of consent, social well-being is so important, we should use them. That's one debate. And then the second debate on top of that is, well, what do you do if the law says no? Wait, do you say that the law is actually wrong in that way because it's connected with ethics and what the law really means is da da da? Or do you just say they're two different things and maybe you break the law? Complicated web for you to think about for just a few minutes. Okay, so what is ethics? How many values and principles? This is the last aspect of our session today. And what's going on here is we're going to talk sort of practically for a little bit here in the end. And specifically, we want to talk practically about how many values we should sort of have in our mind to operate, at least to operate in the field we're interested in, which is computer science and information technology and artificial intelligence. Typically, just stepping back for a moment, typically people call that whole area of ethics, they call it AI ethics, artificial intelligence ethics. This is all so new that it might change. Maybe in the future it will be called information technology ethics or something else. But for the moment, if you hear the term AI ethics, they're talking about that basket of ethical decisions and thinking that surround work in the area of information technology. And what we need to do to start actually doing that work and to begin actually doing ethics is we have to get a decision made about how many principles we are going to be putting in our mind and using to analyze what's going on and understanding fundamentally so we can use them. How many principles do we really need to work capably in the world, at least within the area of AI ethics? And obviously, there are extremes, right? You could say, well, we need just one, or we need a lot. And there are problems with the extremes. So let's just take one extreme. Let's just say we decide we're going to work with only one principle. And we'll say, no matter what happens, I'm just taking the principle of privacy. But it could be anything. It could be autonomy. It could be fairness. It could be social well-being. Anything you like. But there's only one. There's only one principle. If you're going to say, look, we only need to know one principle, that's very good because it's easy to understand. There's just that one principle, but it's going to be so difficult to apply that one principle in diverse situations that the principle will become almost worthless. And the way I'm kind of showing that is through an example of a driverless car. Imagine you are trying to train, and this is very important, you are trying to train a driverless car to recognize a stop sign so that it stops. That's a big deal. You want that. You want the car to stop at the stop sign. And if you only use sort of one principle, which would be something like a mix of, as I'm showing here, a mix of white and red, that's not going to work. It's too broad because every time the car sees any kind of mix of white and red, like you see on the little cloud there, I'm not sure what that would be. That might be an advertisement for a dishwash detergent or something. Who knows, right? On a billboard. Every time the car sees any mix of red and white, it's going to think, stop sign, and the car's going to come to a quick stop, causing a traffic accident with everyone slamming into the car from behind, right? So if you have only one principle or too few principles, then the rules are so vague, so blurry, that they can't actually function effectively in the world. In the same way, if you just say that a stop sign is anything which is red and white, then that won't work for the driverless car. It will be stopping all the time. So you need more than one rule. Then you can go to the other extreme. You can have many, 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 many rules. And in that case, it would be like the stop sign, which is the perfect stop sign, not the one with the gunshot on it, the stop sign with its perfect red and white, that would be the stop sign which is described by many, many rules. It has to have vitality, health, autonomy, privacy, dignity. I mean, in something like this, it would be that the stop sign has to have eight sides perfectly, with each side perfectly as long as the other side, and there must be the perfect red and white boundaries exactly there, and the letters must be perfectly shaped, like the S-T-O-P, right? Something like that is would be a lot of rules. Has to have exactly this size, has to have exactly this shape. The S has to be exactly in this way, the T exactly in this way. Now, if you have a lot of rules like that, the advantage is that it will stop when it sees the perfect stop sign. It will work in that one case where every rule fits coherently and perfectly. However, the real world, we know, is not actually like that. In the real world, stop signs look like the other one I've put on the slide. Everyone seeing that, anyone seeing that, immediately recognizes, okay, Well, that's a stop sign. Of course, I stop. But if you demand, if you tell the car to only stop when it sees perfectly each letter, then when it sees the stop sign with the gunshot, it's not going to stop, right? It's going to say, look, that doesn't fit the rule. That's different than the sign I've been told to stop at, because the O and the P are imperfect. Plus, there's this other stuff up on the top here, which doesn't look like a clean line. So the car, in that case, the Tesla, let's say, will just zoom right through the intersection. And there again, you have an accident. So if you have too few rules, if it's too general, then the car will be stopping all the time for no reason, and you'll have accidents of rear enders. If you have too many rules, it's too specific, then the car will only stop in that one perfect case where there's the sign, but it will be going through all the other signs that actually stop signs that actually exist in the world, which are not perfect replicants of the sign, which is perfectly defined. So in that case, again, you have all kinds of traffic accidents. So for a driverless car, too few rules and too many rules both mean a lot of traffic accidents. You need to have just the right amount of rules. So it won't stop too frequently, but it won't stop insufficiently frequently either. And the same thing is true when doing ethics. If we have just one rule, it's too general, and we won't it won't actually work in the world the way it's supposed to, because take, for example, the idea of privacy. Privacy does work pretty well when we're talking about those glasses that the Google guy was wearing. And privacy works pretty well when we're talking about the x-rays. But when you're deciding how fast to drive on the freeway, that's not really a privacy question, is it? And that's a question more about personal freedom and social well-being. So if we only have the rule of privacy, if we're trying to figure out how fast to drive on the freeway in terms of maximizing people's privacy, it's just not going to work. We need more than one rule to cover all the experience that actually exists in the world. And then we could say the same thing again. If we have 48 million rules that we have to bring to bear on every single decision, well, then we'll never be able to make a decision, right? We'll have to analyze. I'm trying to figure out whether or not I should, you know, let's say, going back to this example, I kind of like, someone gives me $20. I'm trying to figure out, of course, I'm not going to do this. I'm just joking. Someone gives me $20 and I'm trying to figure out whether or not I should give them an A in the class for that. Well, if I have to work through like 47,000 rules, let's see, does this help vitality? Does this help or hurt health? Does this help or hurt? If I have to work through all these rules, I'm never going to be able to make a decision, yes or no. In order to actually make a decision in the world, I need sort of a limited number of rules to work with. Privacy is probably not going to be one of those rules because it's not really a privacy question. It really fits with fairness. If someone gives me $20, the reason I would not give them an A for that $20, they might get an A because they do well in the class, but the reason I would not give them an A for the $20 is because I have an ethical rule of fairness, which is that all the students should be treated equally. And so in terms of the work they do for the class, so the $20 doesn't help. So the set of rules that I want are going to include things like privacy and fairness, so that I can get some different, have different tools to use to work on different problems. But they're not going to be so many, like we see on this side of the slide, that I can't ever actually make a decision. I can't ever get going with anything. Because it's just in practical terms, it won't work. So I think I've explained theoretically this kind of nuts and bolts problem that exists in ethics, in AI ethics, and in all ethics. It is how many principles should we bring to bear generally upon our problems? When we decide to gather together and talk about ethics, we have to decide first, I mean, how many principles we're going to have on the table as part of the discussion. Can't have too many, can't have too few. And here's another example. It's the same point being made again in terms of computer science. This is where you're trying to train a computer to distinguish, let's just say, cats from dogs. cats would be the circles and dogs would be the squares. You want to make a rule that is not a crude, simple rule that ends up mixing up a lot of cats and dogs. But the rule can't be too perfect either for the specific training set, because if it perfectly identifies every cat and every dog in a specific training set, as soon as you leave that training set, as soon as you get new stuff in the world, like new stop signs, the data is not going to work anymore. What you want in order to have a machine distinguish well between cats and dogs is you want it to form a general distinction, like this middle view, which more or less grasps the key characteristics of most dogs and most cats. When you have that, then you can take that out into the world and it will work pretty well. Not perfectly, but pretty well. And it will work better than if the rule is too general or too specific. So the problem you have with driverless cars is just like the problem you have with AI identification of cats and dogs, and it's just like the problem you have with ethics. You can't have too many rules. You can't have too few rules. You need enough rules so you get some good, precise distinctions, but you also need not so many. You have to have kind of flexibility within those rules. So, if that's the background, how many rules should we have? You can tell from what I've given you so far, it seems like most of us who are involved in this think we should have more than one rule and less than 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, less than 30 or whatever number that is, somewhere between 1 and 30. And what most of us in the community think is that the number of rules should be about 7, 8, 9, something in that range. And I have here a few different examples of ethics guidelines for artificial intelligence, which have been produced by different bodies. One on the extreme is the Data Ethics Commission from Germany. You see that they proposed 7 rules that should be the basic ethics values that are brought to the table when people talk about ethics. Their theory is that with these 7 tools, we should have enough rules that are few enough so we can use them, but not so few that they're worthlessly general. So 7 rules is their set. The Ethics Guidelines for Trustworthy AI that was produced by the European Union, their number is also kind of 7. they have something like diversity, non-discrimination, fairness, human agency, and oversight. It's not sure if that's 1 or 2, but it's kind of in that range, right? They're both about 7. We have in this class, or in this seminar, 9. The reason we have 9 is because what I have done is I have gone through and looked at things like the Data Ethics Commission of Germany, the Ethics Guidelines for Trustworthy AI, and a lot of other sets. And I've tried to find, well, I haven't tried to find, I can say confidently that I have found 9 of the principles that recur in almost all of the sets. Some sets have a few more than 9, some have a few less, but if you just look at these two, the Ethics Guidelines for Trustworthy AI and the German Data Ethics Commission, both of them have self-determination or autonomy. It's just different words. Self-determination is the same as human agency, is the same as autonomy. The Ethics Guidelines by the European Union does not have dignity, but the German group does have dignity, so we added that. Everyone has privacy, so that's there. The Ethics Guidelines have fairness, but the Data Ethics Commission does not have that, oddly, so we have that here. The EC, the EU, does not have solidarity, but the Data Ethics Commission of Germany does have solidarity, so we have that here. Sustainability is another way of saying societal and environmental well-being is another way of saying social well-being. That's really the same thing. The Data Ethics Commission has democracy as a value. That's probably because of their, for historical reasons and Nazism and so on. I know that democracy does not appear in all of the guidelines, so I think we can leave that out. That doesn't mean that democracy is unimportant. It just means that it's part of a different kind of study. That's much more about political philosophy than it is about AI ethics. Then we have performance. That's one that is here, but not in the other two. It does exist in other sets, however. Safety is the same as technical robustness, and safety is the same as security. And then explainability is the sum, actually, of transparency and accountability. But that doesn't appear in the Data Ethics Commission. In any case, the point I'm trying to make here, what I'm trying to show you, is that these nine principles, which are the principles we will be looking at, these nine principles are a good estimation of the core set of principles that more or less most all of the people who are doing AI ethics practically out in the world, in cases like I worked on with the COVID case in Russia, most people who actually have experience doing this believe, have found through their own experience, that about 9, 7, 8, 9, about that number, maybe 10, the ethics guidelines, if you break it all up, it might be 10 or 11, but somewhere around 7 to 11 principles is about what you need to work efficiently but completely through the kinds of ethical dilemmas that arise in AI ethics. And so that's what we will be doing in this seminar. We will be looking at these nine, which, as I say, are representative of the core set that exists, that appears over and over again in the literature. Okay. So I think that's probably enough for today. What we have done is we have talked about what the definition of ethics is. And the kind of the fundamental human part of that is this idea that it's a language, right? It's a way of talking about privacy and freedom as opposed to volumes and inches and incentives and costs. So it's a language. And then secondly, it's this idea of evaluation. You cast everything in terms of their intrinsic value. What is this set of Google glasses worth in terms of human privacy, in terms of human freedom? That's the second step. And then the third step, ethics is about privileging values, saying, look, this privacy is worth more than freedom in this case, or in this other case, freedom is worth more than privacy. And then only then do you say something is right or wrong. So that's what ethics is. That's the definition and what it looks like to work with ethics. Then we talked a little bit about this unique question of ethics and law. And we didn't come to any conclusion, but we said you can think of ethics as being an extension of law or as independent from law. And then the last thing we did is we looked at this, the kind of nuts and bolts of ethics, and said, if we're going to be talking about these human values, if that's what ethics is about, then we've got to know how many should we talk about and what are they? And that's, again, what we did here at the end. We said, this is the number we should talk about, and this is what they are. I will give you a few minutes just to think for yourself about whether or not you think that number is a good number. And I think that's enough for this session.